I think as a counselor, what you bring to the session as a human being is your greatest contribution, you know. In other words, it's not a technique. You can know a lot of techniques, you can know a lot of, you know, ways of saying things and this and that, but without the real core of kindness in your heart, it's going to be really difficult to pull the good things out of the other people. So I think to be a good counselor means doing a lot of work on oneself, which means having a daily meditation practice, yeah, and being able to look at our own mind and see how our own mind works, see how the defilements arise in our own mind, and then practicing, you know, the Buddhist teachings for overcoming those defilements and the negative mental states. It's like I said, you know, when you sit down with another human being and you're trying to help, your presence, who you are as a human being, says much more, I think, in terms of the actual benefit you can do. That's worth much more than your degree and your techniques and stuff like that. You can really tune into the other person on a human level and see them as equal. It's not like you're counseling them, you're helping them because you're together and the expert and they're somehow inferior, but you know, it's just one human being to another. We have pain, they have pain. You know, we acknowledge this, and so we can be very open in the way, in that. I think when we have that kind motivation, then when we come to a counseling session, our mind's very fresh, and we're not coming in with an agenda. Because you can see, like, if you're counseling somebody and you have an agenda of what you think they need to understand about themselves, and you have an agenda of what they need to do, what do I need to get this person to do, you know? If you have that agenda, that idea, you know, you're going to run into tons of obstacles because you're not going to be able to listen to the other person with your heart and really hear what they're saying, because you're going to be too busy trying to steer them to do what you think they should do. And I think the real clue in counseling is learning how to listen and being able to listen with empathy, listen with compassion, but without having a lot of expectations. And I think counseling involves helping people solve their own problems. In other words, we don't solve anybody's problems. I mean, I have people coming to me, you know, what do I do, what do I do? And I turn it back and, well, what do you think you should do? And what criteria, you know, are the ones with which you make choices? And what are the priorities in your life? And so I think it's very important to help people get in touch with themselves instead of telling them what to do, telling them things, asking them questions so that they can look inside and figure out what it is that's really going on inside themselves. I always look for patterns, yeah. From a Buddhist perspective, going into all the childhood stuff, it may or may not be helpful, yeah. Sometimes it can be helpful if people need to talk and need to get something off their chest. But I look more for patterns in behavior, yeah, rather than people getting stuck in, you know, well, when I was 4 years old, my mother did this, and when I was five, my father did that. Because I see, at least in the States, people often make too much of an identity about what happened to them in their past. You know, I am a victim of what so-and-so did. And then they make that an identity, and it becomes very difficult for them to change because their identity is painful, but they don't want to give it up because it's secure at the same time. So I try and get people to look more for patterns, patterns of behavior, patterns of emotional reactions, patterns of how they describe a situation to themselves, patterns of what they notice in a situation. You know, because I think when people begin to see their patterns, then they can see how subjective the world they create by those patterns is. They can begin to change it. You know, there's many similarities between Buddhism and therapy. There's also many differences. And I think it's real important to be aware of the similarities and be aware of the differences. And I don't know if, are you counseling mostly Buddhist people? Or people, some people who are, okay, so a little bit of everybody. Okay, because you know, you have to talk to people according to their own world outlook. I was going to say, you know, when you're counseling Buddhist people, you can talk about, you know, you can bring in the perspective of karma and rebirth. And that can often help them understand things in their life. But if somebody's not Buddhist, you can't bring that in. Yeah. Some of the similarities I see, and I'll probably go back and forth between similarities and differences. So I think, you know, both therapy and or counseling and Buddhism are working for human happiness and have the welfare of other beings in mind. Buddhists look at the happiness, though, as going beyond this lifetime. So the happiness that we're seeking as Buddhists is the happiness of liberation, the happiness of enlightenment, the happiness that people who come to counseling are seeking is the happiness of this life, mostly, you know? And the counselor, the therapist, is trying to get them to adapt to the situation of this life. You know, they're not thinking too much about what are the previous karmic causes and what, you know, causes are created for the future. Okay, so, you know, the perspective of what you see as happiness is different. You might, when you're counseling people, have to ask them what they think happiness is. Because some people who come for counseling are looking for spirituality, and then you need to direct them there. Yeah, because I know sometimes people who come to me to learn Dharma are actually needing counseling. So I have to find out what they need, and then if they need that, I send them to a counselor. Okay? I mean, you can bring in both perspectives if you're talking to somebody who's Buddhist. Buddhist believes in no self. In other words, that there's not a solid identity or ego or personality, which we all have. Therapy, in general, tends to believe that there is a self. And I think that's a major difference. Because people always say, I want to find out who I am. In Buddhism, we want to find out who we aren't. Yeah, so it's different there. And I don't know, I think the Buddhist perspective on this, on no self, on selflessness, can be very helpful, because when people hold on to, you know, there's a real me and there's a real personality, then they have a harder time changing because they feel that there's something solid that's them. If they have this idea that there's no solid self or personality or ego, sometimes they begin to feel a little bit nervous and ungrounded, but sometimes they realize that gives them the space to change. Also, when we talk about Buddha nature and, you know, the nature of the mind being clear, and being undefiled, that can be very helpful for people in counseling because they feel like they're defiled and corrupted and innately bad and evil. So even if you talk about Buddha nature, you know, you can talk about it if you have people of other religions, don't use the word Buddha nature, but you just say, you know, our fundamental nature of our consciousness is clear and it's untainted by our anger and attachment and jealousy and pain. And so because, you know, that is untainted by those things, then there's the possibility of change. There's the possibility to develop our good qualities infinitely. And I think just having that perspective on what it means to be a human being is very helpful for people. I work a lot in prisons in the States, you know, giving Dharma talks and counseling prisoners and corresponding with them. And I find that, you know, the things that communicate best is talking about Buddha nature. Because so many people, when they're, when they're down and out, they just feel like they're horrible. They feel shame, they feel guilt, you know, they feel that something's inherently wrong with them and they can't change. And that view of oneself traps them more than anything else. So if you talk about Buddha nature and the possibility of change, it's like these people just light up, you know. It's quite amazing. I find talking about compassion very helpful too. And, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, you start lecturing them on compassion. But, you know, you bring up points like this and give them something to think about. You know, what does it mean to have compassion? And people might say, you know, doing what other people want. And you say, well, is that really compassion or is that seeking approval? There's a difference, you know. But it can be very helpful to, you know, to get people to begin to differentiate between codependent behavior and seeking approval, which is very tied up with ego, you know. Often you hear, oh, people become so codependent and they lose themselves, they don't have an ego. I don't believe that. I think people who are very weak, who are very people pleasers, who just live their life trying to make everybody else around them happy and constantly capitulate, I think those people have very big egos. You know, it's just their behavior is such that they're trying to protect their ego, and their strategy is by giving in and letting everybody else make decisions. But that sense of ego and I want happiness and I'm the most important one in the world is very strong in these people. Yeah, and so I don't think it's correct to say that they don't have strong egos. I mean, therapy may describe a strong ego as being self-confident or something like that, but I'm defining it a little bit differently. I mean, they do have a sense of self. It's just a very negative sense of self. And they do have a strategy for life. It's not that they're giving their power away. You know, they can be extremely manipulative by giving in and stuff like that. So I think they have a strategy. They have an identity, you know? I mean, I think we fool ourselves to think they don't, or that they fool themselves to think they don't also. Yeah, so getting people to differentiate, you know, what's attachment and what's love? You know, because when we're attached to somebody, we get all these weird interpersonal dynamics because we're seeking something out of them. When we really love them, you know, there's fewer strings attached. So, you know, just okay, we can't love people perfectly. We have a lot of attachment, but let's at least notice what our attachment is, what we're seeking from them. And then how we can begin to let go of some of those things that so that we can actually love other people more. Now, pointing out this kind of thing to people. I think that people respond a lot to compassion. Often they say, oh, I wish somebody was compassionate to me, you know, kind of. That's the first thing. I want the world to be compassionate to me. But sometimes giving them a sense that they have their own compassion that can come out can be very inspiring for them, yeah. I mean, I just remember one time giving a talk in a prison, and there was one guy sitting in the room. He had one of these really tough jaws, you know, big jaw kind of sitting there, you know. It's like, I'm glad there's other people in the room with me. I'm sitting in the room with this guy. And he sat there through the talk and the discussion, listening, you know. And then I opened it up for questions, and people were saying different things. And then at one point he said, he sat up and he said, you know, I have a social disorder and it's extremely difficult for me to talk in front of other people, in front of groups, but I have something that's real important for me to say right now. And what you just were talking about living with kindness and generosity, that's how I want to live. And you people need to know that. And I was like, wow! You know? I mean, that we created the space that he felt the confidence to be able to say that. Because in a prison environment, saying you want to live with kindness and generosity is not the in thing to say. You know? But he felt comfortable enough in the atmosphere we created where he could say that, and he could get in touch with that part of himself. And it kind of blew my mind. You know? So I think, like, a lot of the people who come in who are kind of, you know, swaggering, rough, tough ones, you know, if you can kind of scratch the surface and let them know that they have compassion, it can be very helpful for them. I think especially for the men, because men often say, oh, compassion, love, that's women's stuff, you know, we're going to... macho image, you know, but then they just lock themselves in, you know, with that. Yeah, and I think that's when often they get violent. Yeah. His Holiness the Dalai Lama once, when he was talking to young people, this is something for youth, he told them, violence is old-fashioned. Isn't that a great thing, you know? Because kids want to be with it, you know, the new things. You know? Violence is old-fashioned. People have been doing it for centuries. Oh, you know, you need to try something new. So I think getting people in touch with their own inner goodness now, seeing that we're all a mixture of negative qualities and positive qualities. It's not that positive qualities are absent and we're only full of garbage, you know. We have the positive qualities. We can't act them out 100% purely, but what, you know, you're doing in therapy is edging somebody towards that one. You know, getting people to be more aware of their patterns and their own inner dynamics so they can start letting go of some of the selfishness. So, you know, this thing about selflessness being, you know, no solid personality, I think is very helpful here. I've noticed sometimes in therapy in America, and, you know, I hope you understand I'm talking from a background of my experience of therapy in America. Therapy in Singapore, I know, is different because of the cultural difference. But therapy in America, I get the feeling sometimes, I mean, you, of course you have good counselors and bad ones, but it's like sometimes they're encouraging people to be selfish, you know, kind of like, what do you want to do? And, you know, I don't know, there's a kind of an emphasis, I think, because the emphasis is just on this life and on being happy in this life, then there's it can easily go into, well, what do you want? What's going to make you happy? And how can you get what you want? And I think in therapy, it isn't just, you know, how can the client be happy and get what they want, but they live in an interdependent world. And how can they work to benefit everybody in their world? Because if we encourage them just to look out for their own concerns, they're going to be miserable because they're going to pay too much attention to themselves and do actions that harm others. And then other people won't get along with them. You know, but if we say, you know, you have the potential to be compassionate, and you know, how can you seek happiness in an interdependent world? You know, because if you're only looking out for your own and you create suffering in the people around you, then you're going to be miserable yourself, because if we live with miserable people, their misery rubs off on us. And if we make other people unhappy, they do things that we don't like that make us unhappy. So people can start to see that the self-centered attitude, you know, doesn't work, that dumping their own emotions out on other people doesn't work. You know, you have to learn to communicate and understand. I think that's really, really helpful for them. You know, in the States, there's all this talk about expressing your anger, yeah, and people having repressed anger, and, you know, and so sometimes they go into therapy, get in touch with their anger and try and express it. And, I mean, you have to be in touch with your anger and know that you're angry in order to do something about it. But I've also seen people in therapy who think that they should be angry because their therapist thinks they should be angry. And that's what I'm talking about, having an agenda for somebody, you know. This happened to you when you were a kid. Well, you must have suppressed anger, and I'm going to get you to, you know, release your anger. I don't think so, you know. I think we kind of have to let people be and respect them for who they are. And yes, you know, if we have repressed anger, we need to acknowledge it. But then we need to learn how to let go of the anger and move beyond it. Sometimes in therapy in the States, it kind of stops with, you know, you express your anger and then you become more self-assertive. And that's seen as a good thing, you know, you're more self-assertive. But I don't think that that necessarily heals the person, yeah, because if you're more in touch with your anger, but you can't handle your anger well, and if you're assertive, but you're selfishly assertive, and don't take into consideration the feelings of others, then you don't really wind up any happier. You know?